Emerald Podcast Series. Research that makes a difference.
Welcome to the Emerald Podcast Series. I'm your host, Tom Shields, Communications Manager at Emerald Publishing. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Jason Brown, a psychologist and professor with a commitment to strengths-based approaches to mental health. His work is not just about understanding the mind, but also about empowering individuals and communities. Jason's research has taken him into the lives of foster families, Indigenous youth, and service providers, as well as families affected by alcohol exposure. He has a passion for social justice and the drive to make a meaningful impact. Jason is interested in how social justice issues are defined and addressed by professionals in counselling and psychotherapy. His latest book, titled Dismantling White Supremacy in Counselling, draws attention to the issue of white supremacy in professional counselling by looking at the clients, the profession, and public policy. The book's introduction is titled Why Would a White Guy Write Another Book About White Therapists and Their White Clients? And that's the first question that I put to Jason today.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of them out there. In fact, most of the books that, you know, we encounter in our training are written from that perspective. But what is interesting about all of them is that they really are a reflection of the context in which they were produced. And what I mean by that is, you know, Western psychology has whiteness embedded in our work. And I need to say that, you know, my position is as a white middle-aged settler who belongs to the middle class and cisgender and straight. So that's the perspective that I'm speaking from. And as I got thinking more about this and doing some more research to find out some more of the context, I guess, it was pretty clear that the context that produced Western psychology is one that is very Eurocentric, white-centric. And we're taught that Western psychology, you know, is psychology, but it's actually a psychology, not the psychology. And, you know, the history of this psychology is had a lot of times where it was not helpful to groups who are not white. You know, things like eugenics, testing for readiness or position in wartime, the IQ stuff that's come out, you know, making comparisons between races, which is fairly, I think, reasonably debunked. But we also have a lot of research in our field that is based on white folks and a lot of folks who are in school learning about psychology and counseling are learning from primarily, you know, white instructors. And I guess, you know, where it's troublesome for me is that I was always taught that, you know, there's a psychology is for everyone. And when I, you know, knowing these things, how is it possible for a psychology for everyone to be linked to these? You know, clearly they're not benefiting everybody equally. And at the heart of this, I think is, you know, the belief that a lot of folks hold is that whiteness is a, you know, a blank slate, a neutral, a normal. And I have the privilege of being born and raised into that perspective and haven't had to think about what whiteness is. I'm learning that it is, of course, only one perspective. And I never learned about how it's situated in the context of other perspectives. So why would a white guy write another book on counseling? Boy, started with, I think, recognizing my own positionality as a white person. To understand whiteness and white supremacy better, examine white supremacy critically, and then look at the impact on the profession. And then from there, talking about race with white clients, and how that might happen, as well as, you know, what counselors might consider doing and changing their practice, or recognizing maybe the context of their practice and maybe doing things a bit differently.
Mm-hmm. Great. My next question is a short one, but a big one. In your view, what exactly is white supremacy?
Yeah, there are a lot of definitions, and psychology's got a history of looking at, you know, individual behaviors. And that's relevant for sure. But I think it's bigger than that. You know, white supremacy is a system of power and privilege. It privileges white folks over people from other races. It perpetuates racial inequality, and it influences attitudes and behaviors among individuals, but also societal structures.
In the book, you talk about the three pillars of white supremacy. Can you talk us through each of these?
Yeah, of course. I need to be clear about this three-pillar idea, that it's not mine. It's Andrea Smith, who's done some writing about this. But I thought it was really helpful to think about the context in which Western psychology developed. And so when I'm thinking about those pillars, I'm talking at a systemic level about historical events that shaped the life that settlers like me brought to North America from European roots. So colonial expansion imposed hierarchies, racially based hierarchies, and did so hand in hand with the exploitation of indigenous lands and peoples. And it displaced indigenous populations and continues to disadvantage indigenous folks by failing to live up to the terms of treaties that have been signed, and apprehending and scooping children, for example. And along with that came capitalism, which is a system and a belief that values people, values profit over people, and can also treat people as commodities. And it's not a uniter. It's not something that brings people together. It's a divider, in the sense that, you know, it favors those who have wealth to start with, and because of that, more and better opportunities, making the well-off more well-off and the less well-off less well-off. And where that connects with, I think, the realities that we're in today, is that there's a lot of exploitation that went along with it. So you're trying to impose a system on another nation and applying capitalist ideas and considering people as some more worthy than others. And with that in mind, it makes exploitation okay. And what it's done is, you know, created enslavement, forced labor, segregation. And it's been pretty central to the accumulation of wealth and power among white folks and our institutions.
So in the book, you talk about how white supremacy is all around. That is one line that was in the book that caught my attention. So can you give us some examples of how you see white supremacy manifesting itself in everyday interactions?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. There are so many. You know, one of the first ones that came to mind for me is, you know, we look at structural inequality. So, you know, things like social determinants of health and how much those determinants vary according to race and who is on the more advantaged side. And I mean, we're seeing more, I think, evidence and maybe recognition of racialized violence. I'm not sure how it's represented in other places as much as I have a sense from American media and Canadian media, but there appears to be, and the research suggests, more evidence of this happening. The land settlement cases that are ongoing in Canada with Indigenous communities based on broken promises that were made, you know, after contact and during, you know, days of, early days for Europeans on Turtle Island. Media attention, how different races are portrayed differently. And the big one that is really hard to escape and also hard to, understand is the kind of rhetoric that's coming out through the political process and big time in the U.S. as they're heading towards a election. But that happens in Canada too. There are folks who feel emboldened by those kinds of comments and they feel like it's okay to express hate. And that's becoming a lot more present in the media we consume too. So, and as a white guy, I mean, I'm recognizing there are a lot of guys like me teaching counseling and, they're teaching it from their perspective. I teach it from mine. And I can't speak to the realities of being something other than white. And I think that's a problem because there are a lot of folks who are not.
Yeah, you talk about teaching from your perspective. Are there any sort of personal experiences that you'd be willing to share that influenced your decision to write the book?
Man, you know, I did put in the book a bit of a story about when I realized that I was white, and it's kind of an embarrassing one, but it's true because, you know, I grew up in a smallish size rural town in Alberta, Canada, and it was a largely, you know, white community. And I went to school, you know, at universities and lots of teaching from, you know, white folks about the psychology. You know, psychology is one thing for everybody. And I remember after I moved to Winnipeg and wanting to make some connections with the community, I was reaching out to talk to folks who are running Indigenous agencies in Winnipeg, and the comment about, you know, who are you? You know, you're a white guy. What's your intention here? What do you expect to be doing? And it was at that point that I realized I represent a whole lot of stuff that I hadn't considered was mine. The baggage that my race carries when it comes to interacting with folks who aren't. And so that really influenced my awareness of my place and how much the history that people know of, you know, colonization and the impacts there. So when I was talking to students, primarily white students at the university, when we would go and visit organizations and agencies and that kind of thing, it was not something that they were, I think, you know, ready for, frankly, to understand that in the city they live, the area that they were going to was one that very few had any experience with. They stayed in their smaller white neighborhoods. And so that segregation was very, very apparent. And it had a big impact on how I thought about race and how I thought about my teaching of it.
Thank you for sharing that. It's interesting you talk about this idea of realizing and when you realize that you were white. And the book talks about how everyday choices can drive change by recognizing one's racial identity. Can you talk us through this idea of recognizing racial identity and how that can be impactful?
Yeah, well, you know, we all make choices all the time, but I really do believe that the invisibility of whiteness is a serious problem. And without recognizing that, you can't really wrap your head around the idea of white supremacy. So the major challenge comes with this idea that, you know, we live in a racist society and white folks are having a harder and harder time pretending that they're not part of the systems that support it. And that's a really hard thing to accept because it means that I, as a white guy, have had help getting to where I am. I've had advantages just because of the color of my skin, and that there are a lot of people like me, like other white folks, who are doing and saying incredibly damaging things. There's a lot of incentive to pretend it's not something that you are a part of and to point it out in other people. So, you know, for example, in Canada, we have the Charlottesville events that occurred. And, you know, during that Unite the Right rally and the murder, of course, of George Floyd. So I think the big impact of recognizing identity, racial identity, is to recognize how your people's history have been damaging and arrogant, frankly, and as a white person, you're complicit. But you don't have to accept the ways things are. So, for example, you know, where do I buy my groceries? Where does the profit go? Does it stay in the community or leave the community? What about places where we don't spend our money? You know, places I won't go because I know who the benefits from that, and it's not who I want to support. So it means supporting businesses led by Indigenous, Black folks, and people of color. It also means recognizing the racial identity of candidates for leadership positions, whether that be, you know, government at any level, but also, you know, in the community, and ways to, you know, actively recruit, retain, and even do some succession planning for the next person coming forward to be in a leadership role, and then, you know, voting accordingly. But the big one is what professional material we consume. You know, what are the positionalities of the authors who are writing it? What does that tell you about the perspective that's being shared? And the big one for me is, you know, we learn about the history of psychology when it's really the history of Western psychology. And what does that mean for practice with, you know, folks who are not a product of that Western experience, frankly? And how does that impact the work we do and the folks who are not necessarily included in the ideas of what people and the mind and change look like in counseling and psychology?
We've kind of touched on this, but what kind of challenges do you think people face when trying to recognize the racial identity? If that positive ambition to do that is there, what might stand in their way?
Boy, well, I guess, you know, coming to some awareness that, first of all, you know, white is a race and that it means something. It's not just, you know, the absence of anything, but it's actually the presence of something. And starts there, I think, but then beginning to recognize what that means and how that impacts other people. And then seeing how it's reflected in the institutions all around us. That's pretty humbling to you know, be able to wrap your head around as a white person. And even though you don't feel like you might be, quote, racist, well, you're a product of a society that is. So, you know, you got to come to terms with that awareness if you, you know, choose to go that way. It can lead to a lot of guilt for folks. It can create a lot of resistance and coming out in the forms of anger and, you know, and accusations and things like that. I think it's also the absence of folks who are white, who are role models for anti-racist practice. And we don't have that kind of book in psychology. And that's not what I wrote about, but it would be a lovely addition to have a book of people who have, white folks who have actually been very progressive in their perceptions of things and wanted to make some change along the way. So we don't have a lot of good white role models to follow when it comes to this stuff.
So it's interesting that we're talking about this lack of awareness, and potentially that might lead to some common misconceptions about white supremacy. And have you seen any of these misconceptions in the world?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the biggest misconceptions is that, you know, white supremacy is something that is, it's a label we could apply to people who do really extreme and, you know, obvious and intentional harm to communities of color and indigenous folks. And that the way things are in the status quo, that is the political and social and economic context we live in, are the way things are supposed to be. Almost this idea that, you know, you can't challenge the system because it's held together for a long time already, and it's been exported all over the world and taken up in a lot of places around the world, but it didn't originate there. And I think a misconception is not adequately recognizing all of the history and ways of knowing and ways of being, as well as healing, that are culturally dependent and not part of Western psychology. So those are some of the things. That idea that there's a, you know, a superior and inferior kind of you know, lens to research and counseling, healing.
Thank you. The book ends, Jason, with two chapters, one on action inside of the clinical encounter with white clients, and the other on action outside of the clinical encounter. Can you talk us through these two settings, the actions you're talking about, and how they differ?
Yeah, I think this is the difficulty that, you know, a lot of us face doing work in counseling, is that a lot of what we do, it happens in a private office, you know? And there are some things that can happen there that can be really helpful. I mean, one of the things is talking about race, you know, with white folks. I mean, it's not something that comes up very often. And sometimes you have to think a little bit deeper about what might be underneath the things that people are presenting with, like trouble at work or, you know, neighbors or whatever the things might be, and what's underneath all of that. So that's one way. And considering, you know, is that what you want to be? Do you want to be one who enjoys and benefits from all of the systems and the interactions that occur, but knowingly disadvantaging and pushing to the side perspectives and views that are not your own, and seeing them as, you know, in some way inferior. Addressing white fragility is a big part of it. You know, I think the defensiveness and resistance to these kinds of conversations are a challenge in counseling. But that's only the, you know, the micro level or interpersonal level. But thinking about, you know, the systems and structures that are the reason, you know, racism is perpetuated. And so things like, you know, advocacy, it could be advocacy on behalf of a client or on behalf of an issue. But things that can lead to some larger level change. So another thing that counselors could do would be to, you know, collaborate with community organizations, you know, be involved in protest and support initiatives, you know, that focus on racial justice. Another thing is to educate yourself and others about race, privilege, and oppression. And finally, I think, you know, one of the words that I'm seeing written about is the role of co-conspirator, and you're actually working in a subversive way to challenge the status quo. Now, I'm not talking about revolution, although, you know, I don't know that we're going to be making that happen. But in terms of educating and folks recognizing, that I think can be quite powerful, and sometimes, you know, challenging the powers that be is, it is going to be necessary.
Jason, if you had to choose one action that a reader would take after reading your book, what would it be? I realize that's a very tough question.
Yeah, I think education. I think learning about histories as opposed to history. I think learning about psychologies and not just psychology. And learning from folks in the community about the work that organizations and communities are taking to make changes and to be supportive in that way, listening to the wisdom of the folks who are on the front lines of this, and get involved, at least vote.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. For more information on today's guest and for a transcript on the show, please visit our website. I'd like to thank Dr. Jason Brown and the studio This Is Distorted.